It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a member of the trans community about Transgender Day of Visibility. It's being celebrated today.
First, some voters in Wisconsin are going to the polls tomorrow to vote on whether to increase property taxes to maintain regular operations in their school districts.
The 26 school districts are asking to raise property taxes above the state set limit, and they're not out to fund new projects. They just want to keep what they have in place.
Many of the primarily rural school districts say they've already used any budget flexibility provided to them by Act 10 and now face layoffs and cuts to programs. Here with us to talk about tomorrow's referenda is Superintendent of the Oakfield School District in Fond du Lac County, Sue Green. Sue, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So 26 districts we're talking about tomorrow are going to be putting it to the voters to raise taxes to pay for school operations. How big does that number seem to you?
It's awfully big number. We have a lot of districts that are going through exactly what we are going through, really facing some difficult challenges on funding our schools and keeping our district afloat.
And why would you say this is such a widespread issue? Why has it come to a head right now?
In the 1993-94 school year, Wisconsin changed the way that they funded the schools. And we are seeing more and more districts that can't make ends meet because of the change in the school funding.
Now, the Walker administration intended Act 10 to help give school districts flexibility to make up budget shortfalls through, for instance, pension negotiations or teacher salaries. What about those mechanisms? Did they work?
Well, we certainly made a significant number of cuts in both of those areas since last year. Last spring, the Oakfield School District had a referendum, the same referendum that had failed. And as a result of that, for this school year, they had to make significant cuts in staffing. We have made major changes in the insurance and benefits packages for all teachers. Our staff are kind of working on a bare bones kind of budget. Our staff this year are under a salary freeze. So we have made significant cuts.
So you're saying the tools were there and you use them and it's still not cutting it?
Correct.
What about funding from the state? Where does that stand?
It is, what it has been for the last number of years. And that formula is very complex. It is really hurting the small school districts. And we are hoping that the state will take a look at what's happening to the small rural school districts.
Is the cost of educating students going up?
Well, I think the cost of everything is continually going up. There isn't a change necessarily in that way, but so many things that are a part of your school budget have gone up significantly. The biggest part of any school budget is your entire pay for your staffing and the benefits. And the benefits, the cost of insurance for everyone, whether you're working in a school district or a private venue, those are quite high and continuing to rise, and causing a lot of difficulties for everyone in the employer's seat. We are looking at just the cost of everything, the cost of fuel, the cost for transportation. They all impact us such a great deal.
Now, there are caps that are in place for property tax hikes for schools to increase revenue. So how hard a sell is this going to be, this referenda?
Well, I think what we're saying is that we want everything to stay the same way that it is. And to do that, looking at what we have for our enrollment and what we're projecting for the next couple of years, we need the support directly from our taxpayers. And so we are asking for, ours is a six-year referendum, which is, I think, on the part of our school board, a pretty courageous step to take to look out that far out in the future and say, this is what we need, 3 years with $1 million increase. And then the following three years would be a $1.2 million increase.
Now, this is your second year going to the taxpayers themselves, right? What happened last year?
Yes, it is. I was not here last spring. I came on board July 1st of this year. So I'm only looking at what I understand happened in the district. I think that overall there was a feeling that it wasn't as dire. and that there still could be a lot more cuts to be made. So when it failed last spring, the school board and the administration made the significant cuts they needed to get through this school year. And it was very painful to the district, to the community. There were a lot of individuals who had their positions cut and a great deal of cutbacks in what we're able to do as a school district.
How much is your school district asking to raise this time around?
We are asking for a six-year referendum, $1 million a year for 3 years, and then for the next 3 years, a $1.2 million a year.
And flesh that out a little bit for us. What exactly would that be going to pay for?
It's continually a part of our operations. So it supports the current funding that we get from the state, and it allows us to keep all of our programs and staffing right at the point that we're at. And we feel that we're doing a great job. We have an excellent academic record. We do well on the state report card, on our state assessments, and we're considered by so many in the area as a school district of choice. We have a very high open enrollment, people that want this kind of an environment to educate their children. And so we're looking at maintaining everything that we have and not being forced to make any additional cuts.
Well, let's say tomorrow rolls around and the referendum doesn't pass. Taxpayers don't want to increase revenue for the schools by raising their taxes. What are the ramifications? What happens at your school next year?
Mm-hmm. We know that we would begin the process of, again, significant cuts, and this time it will be more of the specific programming options that are available at
like
a secondary
what?
Level, like your agriculture, your technology, things that are not absolutely required for a graduation, but give a student options and a well-rounded choice for a child's future.
What about arts programs, say?
The arts program, all of them would be on the line.
Mm-hmm. And teachers' jobs, what about those?
Again, we would have to look at that. That's what it's going to have to come to so that we could maintain and function one more year.
And is it possible that the school itself could close?
That is very possible. Right now, we estimate that we have funding to get through the good part of next year, and that is based on the projections for how many students we currently have enrolled. Our fear is that if the referendum does not pass, we would have students, families making the decision to open enroll and go to a nearby district rather than wait for the end of the school district. We really do see it as a very dire situation if it does not pass.
It seems common so far, just looking at the track record, that these kinds of referenda are not passed. You're one of 26 rural schools who are looking to raise revenue through tax hikes. I wonder, what do you think is at stake, especially as regards rural schools, if this trend continues and maybe these referenda continue to have trouble passing?
Mm-hmm. I guess that's a very good question for the lawmakers in the state of Wisconsin, the Department of Public Instruction, to look at what's happening to something that's been a backbone in the state of Wisconsin, that we have a variety of sizes of school districts, and many families opt for the small, intimate, rural school setting where all of the children know each other, the families know one another, the staff know the families extremely well. It's a very close-knit community, and there's a great deal of pride in the children and the school district.
Sue, thank you so much for joining us today.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Sue Green, superintendent of the Oakfield School District in Fond du Lac County. Voters around the state will head to the polls tomorrow to decide whether to raise taxes to fund regular operating costs in at least 26 rural school districts.
Today, March 31st, is Transgender Visibility Day. It's a day to recognize the trans people in our community. And joining us now is Catherine Kimford, a member of the trans community and an LGBT activist. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start out with some basic definitions, just so we're all on the same page with what we're talking about. What is the definition of a transgender person?
Well, you really break down the word trans, meaning crossing over a boundary, gender. And now gender being different from sex in that sex is a physical characteristic. Gender is a psychological, a cultural characteristic. So you put the words together. Transgender is kind of a very broad term to describe anyone for whom the original assignment they were given at birth, whether it was male or female, that does not fully describe their life, their identity, whether it's someone who feels they embody characteristics of both genders, or whether it's someone who physically crosses over to live a life as a gender opposite what they were assigned at birth.
Right. And that those two words, that transgender, transsexual, are often, I think, and you should tell me if I'm seeing this correctly, but they're often sort of used, you know, in place of each other in everyday conversation by most people who don't understand that distinction.
Right. Transsexual is specifically talking about the physical transition.
Mm-hmm.
So people who go through hormone treatments, surgical treatments to make their bodies conform to their identity. Transgender is a broader term, just encompasses more people because there are a lot of ways to identify.
So let's talk a little bit about why you're here today. Today is March 31st. It is Transgender Day of Visibility.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a holiday I think a lot of people have heard of. It's relatively new. And what are you trying to do? What's the purpose of this?
Well, there's a lot of things to accomplish. It's a day to just kind of celebrate who we are, what we have, our place in the world, our place in the community. Just, you know, we've done a lot of good things, a lot of famous things that a lot of people don't know about. And, you know, there's a lot of people in the general community not familiar with transgender people. And just taking a day to be out there, to put ourselves like, hey, look at us. This is who we are. Just kind of join the world.
So in terms of that holiday, how do you think, I mean, it's only been underway for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there has been, have you noticed in your community that there's been some effectiveness here, that there is a rising level of awareness about transgender, the role that it plays in the community and various communities, I should say, around the state?
Definitely each year it is getting better. I haven't seen, I mean, it's too much of a new holiday. There hasn't been too much specific Transgender Day of Visibility mm-hmm. observances, but I have seen, just even in the last 10 years, a big jump in awareness overall.
So how do people who are trans or who are trans allies celebrate this particular day?
Well, there's a lot of, this holiday started online is how the word got out. So I know there's a lot of just posts on social media. That's kind of how I have been observing the holiday the past few years. There's also, especially around Michigan where it started and in the Bay Area where there's a huge flourishing LGBT community. And even around the world, I know Dublin I saw on the Transgender Day of Visibility page, has some festival going on. So there are community events. There are not a lot of them yet, but it's filling a need. The holiday is filling a need the trans community's had for a while. So it is gaining steam. I think in the next few years we'll see more.
So let's talk about that need. What is it precisely that when you talk about needs, are you talking about misconceptions, the need to increase visibility, or all of those things?
I think the two are kind of tied together. There are a lot of misconceptions so often in the media. You see transgender characters that are either inaccurate, they're put in for comedic effect, or they're put in and they're really drag queens is what they're portraying. And we're just ordinary people that happen to have this interesting bit to our history, and we are in all walks of life. I think there's misconceptions that for male to female transgender people that, you know, we're kind of hyper-feminized, that we're not going to be interested in sports or have relationships with women, or, you know, play, you know, be auto mechanics or grill out on the 4th of July. You know, we do all those things. I mean, it doesn't change who we are because we have this one element of our history.
So what other misconceptions are there? Are there, you know, one of the misconceptions that occurs to me is that the idea of transgender has been around for a really long time. And some people might be thinking, well, you know, this is only something that's popped up in the last 10 or 15 years, and I suspect that just isn't the case.
It goes back much further than that. Cultures, aside from kind of our American westernized culture, there's a two-spirit identity in many Native American tribes. There's third gender identities in several other Eastern places. I'm blanking on some of the specifics. But even within Western culture, transgender people have been around. They haven't had the medical resources to do the transition, the physical element we have today. But there have been, it's a centuries old phenomenon. It's nothing new. It's the only thing new is that, you know, we're more visible, we're more, it's less of something we have to brush under the rug. I mean, a lot of people still do need to kind of hide that aspect of their history, but it's getting better.
So in terms of stories, does everybody have an individual story as to how they came to this place of transgender?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not only does everyone have their own path to a destination, but people have different destinations. I mean, there's people who, like myself, do a full physical transition. There are people who feel they identify with elements of both genders and they'll live their life that way without medical transition. Or there's some people that just don't feel the need for a medical transition, but they are living their life in a gender other than what they were assigned at birth. And, you know, different moments in our life as far as starting that journey, kind of, it's something we all kind of knew early in life, typically when you talk to people, and then we all have different moments of kind of understanding what that means, and how we go about that journey. So
part of the holiday, as I understand it, is recognizing some of the contributions that trans people have made, to society at large. And so what are some of those things that we might be surprised to learn?
Well, if you use a computer that's smaller than a car, you owe that to the trans community. Lynn Conway is the name of a computer engineer who made computer circuits incredibly more efficient. There's been a few other computer, like the Acorn microcomputer from the, I think it was the late 70s, early 80s, that was primarily designed by a transgender woman. Tuberculosis screening, that was a transgender man who developed the current process of using x-rays to screen for tuberculosis. Outside of sciences, there's a lot of entertainers, particularly what I know from being a video gamer. A lot of classic, like 8-bit early Atari era games were designed by transgender women. So
as we take a look at the holiday as it's being celebrated right now, what are your hopes for it in terms of it developing in the next couple of years? Do you want it to get big, 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 or just to a point where it raises awareness and it's out there and people realize what it is?
I'd like to see it get to a big thing. I mean, there are a lot more transgender people than people realize. And we've done a lot for our communities. We've done a lot for the world. And there is a more well-known holiday, Transgender Day of Remembrance, which does talk about, you know, the victims of violence. And I think that really only tells one part of the story. And having this day of visibility to really show not what the world has done to us, but what we have done for the world, for our communities, I think is a very important thing, a very important part of transgendered culture, of global culture.
So we've only got about 30 seconds or so left, and before we leave today, what is the one thing that you'd want our listeners to know about transgender people that they may not know now?
That we're just like you, you know? It sounds cheesy, but it's true.
Well, Catherine, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking with Catherine Kimport, who is a member of the trans community and an LGBT activist. From Prince Valiant to Peanuts, Bloom County to Calvin and Hobbes, comic strips have been a fixture in newspapers for over 100 years. But with many newspapers now going out of business or switching to web-only formats, the comic strip is in the midst of a very difficult transition.
Our next guest tells the story of the comic strip in a new documentary. Frederick Schroeder is a cinematographer and filmmaker. Dave Kellett is the creator and cartoonist of webcomics Sheldon and Drive. Their new film is called Stripped, and it opens tomorrow on iTunes. Dave, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
And Frederick, good to have you along, too.
Oh, thanks for having us, yes.
Well, Dave, I want to start with you. Could you walk us through some of your earliest and obviously very powerful comic strip memories?
Absolutely. I have a really strong memory, as so many people do, of being on the floor with the Sunday comics spread out in front of me, and they felt like they were five times bigger than me. And it was a world that I could just dive into. I love the colors. I love the characters. I loved the passion and the humor that a cartoonist would create. And it was a joy that sort of lasted with me into adulthood.
What were your early faves?
Oh, I remember growing up and absolutely loving Bloom County and Calvin and Hobbes and The Far Side. I was sort of a child of the 80s, so those were the sort of the triumvirate for me. And then as I got older, I started to explore, you know, cartoons from the pre-war years and just saw a whole century of amazing stuff being produced in the U.S. and Canada.
And Frederick, we'd like to bring you into the conversation right now. You know, it's hard to believe that with the history of the comics that we haven't seen something like this already. What led you and Dave to undertake this, what I suppose to be just a massive undertaking of sort of documenting the comics?
Well, that was our feeling, too. When we started talking about it, we couldn't believe that there wasn't a movie talking about comics, this medium that, you know, is as American as jazz or, you know, baseball. And we couldn't imagine that no one had sort of, you know, delved into this subject fully. So originally I had approached Dave about making a documentary about artist studios, and I wanted to show, you know, a painter and a cartoonist and a sculptor. And Dave was the one who sort of came back and said, well, have you thought about focusing just on cartoonists and cartooning, especially now, because this could be an art form that may not be around for much longer. And so we felt it was important to document this. And this was, 4 years ago, so documentaries take a little bit of time for the scope that we did, because we ended up visiting over 70 cartoonist studios for it.
Yeah, and as I understand it, and I've seen the trailer, I haven't seen the film yet, but the path that you chose is this sort of period of transition we're in right now for newspapers, but that definitely has an effect on the world of the comics.
Oh, for sure. We hope that comics in our doc sort of stands in for what's happened to music, what's happening to movies and TV in this sort of curious transition from analog to digital, with the internet has sort of changed everything and the way that everybody consumes things. So we felt it was sort of an important medium to concentrate for that transition. But I think it's applicable for a lot of other art forms that have gone through that difficult time in recent years.
Now, you talked about how you got some 70 comic writers to come on and talk about their art form. And one voice that you got, who is famously reclusive, he's sort of the J.D. Salinger of comics, Bill Watterson, the creator of Calvin and Hobbes. How did you end up getting him?
Well, we were very lucky, I think, in that, for one thing, he's a very kind man and a big believer in the art form of comics. So when he saw that here were two filmmakers trying to take a serious and heartfelt look at the comics page and the power of that art form, I think that resonated with him. And I think it also helped that for one, there was a cartoonist among the crew working on the film, and that also that we had done at that point maybe 20 or 30 interviews before we approached him. And I think word had sort of trickled back in the cartooning community that here were two filmmakers that weren't out to do any kind of diminishing look at comics or even an attack style look at comics, but something that was almost a love letter to comics and looking at it from a serious perspective. And so I think all that sort of helped weigh his decision. But ultimately it came down to him being an incredibly, incredibly kind man And we couldn't be more thankful to him for that.
And we have just a little clip of his voice from the trailer. Here's a clip of Bill Watterson, creator of Calvin and Hobbes.
In the right hands, a comic strip attains a beauty and an elegance that really I'd put against any other art.
Now, Bill Watterson also drew the poster art for Stripped. How did that come about?
That was really an act of generosity from Bill Watterson. You know, it's sort of 95% his generosity and 5% us, you know, asking. And basically it was when we set out to do the movie, we thought, you know, who would be number one on our list to talk to, and it was Bill Watterson because he had such an influence, I think, on both of us and on just about every cartoonist, you know, our age. And so we never thought we would get him, and when he agreed to do it, we were so taken aback and grateful of that. When it came time to put the poster together, we sort of had the same thought that the person we'd most like to do the poster would be Bill Watterson, but we never thought, you know, he'll never do this. And basically we asked him, you know, emailed him, said, you know, would you be willing to do this? And he said, well, can I look at the movie first? And we nervously sent over the film, and he liked it enough to sort of come back and say, well, you know, I haven't done a comic in 19 years. I hope I remember how to do it, but I have an idea. And we let him go, and he came up with a great illustration.
Well, this is radio, so we're going to ask you to describe the picture for us, because once I saw the whole thing, it was very, very cool. I have to say that.
Yeah. So the title of the film, as you remember, is Stripped, which is sort of a wonderful play on words for comic strips. And he picked up on that for the poster image, and he drew, I guess, what you would call a cartoonist in their 50s or 60s, holding a newspaper with a big headline that says, Bye-bye Newspapers. And the cartoonist at his drawing board is reacting with shock, so much so that all his clothes are flying off of him. So he's standing there absolutely stripped naked. And then sort of as your eye, you know, takes that in, after a minute you notice that the cartoonist dog in the foreground is flipping through an iPad in the foreground. And so it's a really nice composition, very funny, and it's so appropriate to his style and yet so different. And it just came out wonderful.
Yeah, I have to say, it took me a while to figure it out, but then again, I'm a little slow. And then once I did, we had it. We're talking to Frederick Schrader and Dave Kellett. They are co-directors of the documentary Stripped, about the past, present, and future of comic strips and the people who create them.
And you can join in. We want to know what your favorite comic strip of all time is. And do you have a favorite web comic maybe that you still read today? Is there one that you read as a kid and you've introduced maybe to your children? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org.
Teachers have been telling stories for a long, long time. So I'm gonna tell you all about it with this rhyme. Here we go. If you go to Lascaux, France, you'd see paintings in a cave.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is a song by Kate Micucci from the new documentary Stripped, telling the story of comic strips.
And we're joined by the directors of the documentary with us, Frederick Schrader and Dave Kellett. And we're asking you to join us as well at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite comic strip, past or present? And does the fact that a lot of comic strips these days are winding up on the web make a difference? Or do you prefer to have them on the pages of your good old newspaper? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Dave, before the break, we were talking a little bit about that poster that Bill Watterson drew, and the headline, the Goodbye Newspapers headline there. And from your perspective as somebody who is in the business, I hate to use cliches, but it sure sounds like a game changer to me.
Yeah, it's absolutely a game changer. But the good news for comics, I think, is that it doesn't mean the end of the medium. The platforms change, but the art form survives, thankfully. And in some respects, it becomes more powerful, because when you remove the middleman of the newspaper, the editor, the syndicate, it's this direct artist-to-audience relationship. And so in some respects, it becomes a more powerful, more engaging, more hilarious, for lack of a better phrase, relationship between this comic creator and the reader. So I think the future is actually very bright for comics, and the film reflects that optimism.
What about the way that the comics themselves are drawn, Dave? Because I think about a cartoonist, I think about someone who's sitting down with a pen in their hand or a brush, and they're creating by hand instead of a mouse and a computer screen. How has that changed things?
Oh, well, that's absolutely changing as well. So I do two strips. Sheldon is sort of an all-ages strip that I draw in traditional ways with a Bristol board paper and pen and ink and brush. And it's a sort of a handcrafted, you know, traditional system. And then my science fiction strip, Drive, I draw using what most readers or most listeners wouldn't be familiar with. It's called a Cintiq. And it's basically digital paper. It's a giant monitor that's specially built for a pen, so that you can draw right on it. And so that never exists in the physical world. It only exists digitally. I sort of dip and dive back and forth, and that's true with many cartoonists now. It's some don't even touch a pen or a paper ever in their career anymore, and that's completely different than how it was even 10 years ago.
Do the drawings still have voice? You know, when I think about the Peanuts cartoons, the drawings had such character and such individuality. Can you get that when you're using digital tools?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it really doesn't change anything in terms of the final product to what you or I would see as the final comic strip, aside from maybe some technical stuff that can change. Really, it's still the same thing of a single person sitting down at a desk. Now it's just with a digital piece of paper rather than a physical piece of paper and drawing a little multiple-panel comic strip for you to take in on a day-to-day basis. So there's very much still characters, there's still arcs, there's still personal stories that are poured into it, and the relationship is just as strong as ever. It's just a very different way to create it.
To me, it's very similar to, for filmmaking, it's the difference between shooting on film and shooting on, you know, with a digital camera. You know, it's just the technology that's changed, but it's the expression is still very much the same.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So one of the things that I'd like to ask about is sort of the impact, because you both talked a little bit about that relationship that the cartoonist has with their audience. But, you know, if you think of something like Peanuts or maybe even Bloom County or Calvin and Hobbes, those things had they were sort of part of the pop culture. Are those days of having a cartoon that had that kind of impact gone, or is it just moving to a different place?
Well, no, I think Fred and I and most cartoonists would agree that that's absolutely changing. But that's true if you think about it with American culture in general. You know, it used to be that everybody would sit down at the end of the day and watch Johnny Carson. And now you and I might have completely different tastes in television because we have 300 channels on cable. So, and the same is true with music. It's true with the fiction we read. It's true with the comics we get. So we no longer have sort of the water cooler comics that everybody in the office would chat about the next morning. But the upside to that is that we have more cartoonists speaking to more voices and different audiences that never were written for before. So in many ways, it's broadening the audience and speaking more passionately to specifics than it was to general, broader audiences.
And we're going to go to the phones right now. We've got some folks waiting to talk to you both. And by the way, we have an open line for you to join in. Tell us about your favorite comic strip growing up and maybe one that you still love now. What about one maybe you passed on to your kids? 1-800-642-1234 is our number. And we go to Maureen in La Crosse. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. And I'm calling about a relatively new comic strip that I read in Egg Review. It's a farm newspaper based out of Madison, but kind of covers a three-state area, and it's called Lean on Leon.
Uh-huh. And what is that one about?
Well, it kind of talks about different things that you would run into with modern-day farming versus maybe older-time farming, and how all the changes, when you stop and think about them, can be kind of funny. So I look forward to reading that one every week.
And that one is in an actual newspaper, right?
It is in an actual newspaper, Egg Review.
Excellent.
It's a farm newspaper.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Maureen, for telling us about Lean on Leon. I don't know if you guys have heard of that one, maybe Dave, but there's apparently still a market for cartoons that are printed in newspapers, I guess, right?
Absolutely. And what's nice is there's, like I said, the audience is still out there. You know, everyone sort of thinks of comics as being written for kids. And in a way, they were always sort of written for adults. They just took kids in mind. So there's still definitely millions and millions, tens of millions of people that love to read comic strips on a day-to-day basis.
It's also interesting how flexible the medium is, that it could service, you know, people who are interested in farming or video games or whatever subject under the sun, you know, like you could make a comic strip just about anything.
Let's go back to the phones right now, and we've got another caller who'd like to join in. Chris is with us from Middleton. Hi, Chris.
Good afternoon. You folks don't know, but you just performed a wonderful service. You reminded me that Stephen Pastis of Pearls Before Swine is appearing in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
6 o'clock at a room of one's own. And I would have forgotten it if I hadn't heard this. My question is, you know, I think of Pastis and a lot of people, maybe including Bill Watterson, as kind of the young Turks in comics. Like, there's been a real generational change. First, is that right? And who do you focus on in your movie? Who are the folks that you are actually talking to?
Great question, Chris. Thanks so much. And Frederick, how about if you take a shot at that one?
Well, Seven Passes is actually in our movie, and he was one of the more interesting and animated interviews that we had. We sort of got into a little bit of a debate with him over the future of comics, and so he's definitely highlighted in the film. But other people we talked to were, you know, Kathy Geiswise, who did Kathy, Jim Davis, who does Garfield, Kate Beaton, who does a webcomic called Hark a Vagrant, among about 55 other people that actually made it on screen. Who else, Dave? Who am I forgetting?
Well, bigger ones that folks might know from online, Penny Arcade, The Oatmeal, and from the newspaper page, Family Circus, Foxtrot, and the list goes on and on. And the nice thing is I think we kind of, even though this sounds, when you say 55 different voices, even though that's a lot of people in a film, I think everybody sort of gets to chime in a meaningful way, and the pace of the film doesn't really lag because we have such a varied chorus of voices in the film.
And Dave, I want to ask you, you know, we've been talking about the difficulties that cartoonists can face as newspapers go away and struggle, and that cartoonists are making the transition to the web. Is there a new generation of artists who have never worked in print and the web is the only medium they know?
Yeah, and what's interesting is that the generation that's coming up now, and even that's already professionals, kind of don't have and never did have the desire to be in newspapers because they didn't grow up with it themselves in the house. So it's a totally new generation of cartoonists. And they're very different from the traditional syndicated cartoonists in the same way that, like, a Robert Crumb would have been very different from a syndicated cartoonist. It's just a very different kind of personality. They're more entrepreneurial. They're more likely to wear all the hats. And they control not only their own business, but they have complete and total voice to their audience. So they have a direct line. So it breeds a very different personality of the artist that's attracted to that.
So it sounds
the other
like,
thing that,
go ahead. Go ahead.
The other thing that I found was super interesting is that there's a whole generation of people that are discovering comics for the first time on the internet and really have no idea that comics are in the newspaper as well. There's a whole generation, you know, that's web savvy, that's where they find comics, and that's the only place they find comics.
Now, the two of you sound like you're pretty optimistic about this transition to the web, but is there a danger that comics could slip between the cracks and lose their relevancy, stop being a cultural touchstone for America as a whole?
I think there is a danger of that, just because everyone's attention is now, everybody is sort of vying for your attention, and there's so many different mediums out there, from video games to television, to web videos, that comics, I think it's very difficult for them to have the same kind of influence they had in, say, the 40s or 50s or even the 80s with something like Garfield. So I think it is a problem, but at the same time, it's also an opportunity to reach so many more people and so many different kinds of people that were never serviced by traditional comic strips.
So let's talk, we've just got a couple minutes left in the program here. Who are some of the emerging artists that people should be paying attention to?
Oh, wow, that's a really good question. There's probably 36 I could name right off the bat. A few I'll name and a few Fred can name. I think Ryan North with Dinosaur Comics has some of the sharpest writing going, as does Kate Beaton of Hark a Vagrant. I think for gaming-type strips, PvP and Penny Arcade are fantastic. I think the Oatmeal has some amazing sarcasm and cynicism in his work that I enjoy immensely. Fred, who else would you chime in with?
Well, for me, I was a big fan of the old adventure strips like Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon. And there's a strip called The Abominable Charles Christopher that Canadian cartoonist Carl Kerschel does that I think is just beautifully done and an amazing strip to view online, especially.
And Fred, in our last 30 seconds here, your film is opening on iTunes, it sounds like, huh?
Yes, we're tomorrow we're doing a big launch on iTunes, and we're trying to be the first sort of truly independent movie to get to number one. So we're trying, at least for a day, and so we're trying to get as many possible hits on that as we can. So if you have iTunes and are Apple friendly, please go and pick up Strip Film tomorrow.
And you can find the link on strippedfilm.com. And so tomorrow's the big push to get to number one.
All right. Well, good luck with that. And thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
That was Frederick Schroeder and Dave Kellett, co-directors of the documentary Stripped. It's released tomorrow on iTunes.